Hi, you're listening to Karma Has Spoken. I'm Danielle Carmanis, and I'm here in my trailer named Lucy, and we're so happy you're on this ride with us. What do a llama, a delicious cocktail, and a retro trailer have in common? Well, it's the life of the party you never knew you needed. And right now, a perfect companion for my trailer, Lucy. Leave it to Lauren Laschek and Kim Warner to craft the coolest bar in Detroit and then take their show on the road. Hi, ladies.
Hi.
How are you?
Oh my gosh, I love that so much.
That was the best intro ever.
I mean, how cute is the llama?
We're pretty obsessed.
I mean, it's an obsession. So how did it come to be, the llama, the name, the whole situation? Because you weren't out looking to start a bar and take it on the road.
So Kim and I and our husbands, Ron and Kyle, were all four best friends.
And how long have you been friends?
Well, since high school.
Yeah.
You're kidding. Yeah. A really long time. My husband and Kim have been friends since grade school.
Yeah.
And we, you know, accepted Kyle to the bunch.
I don't know how many years.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. So we're four best friends. We hang out all the time, mostly over a craft cocktail.
Or two, yeah.
Or three. And so we've just, for a while, every time we would get together, we would kind of just have this fun conversation. What can we do together? What would be fun? What would be something on the side? Because we all have different careers. So really, as soon as Kim and Kyle started planning their wedding, that's when like the spark came for this idea for a mobile bar. Kim got married out in San Diego.
Okay. And then we were looking around in this area too for mobile bars. And then we kind of wanted to make our own and put our own touch on it once we found the trailer that
we were. Sure. Yeah. And we were shocked there wasn't one at all that we could find. Like we literally searched one night over a couple beers, Detroit mobile bar, and like nothing popped up. And I'll never forget, they left our house. And then that night I texted Kim. I'm like, just so you know, I saved the Instagram handle.
Because this is happening. They're like, okay.
Literally said coming soon, 2019 or 2018.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So from the time you had the idea until it became a reality, how long did it take?
I mean, the idea to finding a trailer was literally like a couple days.
Yeah.
I was on Craigslist searching and I sent it to them in a group text message like, so this is happening, right? And they were kind of like, haha. I'm like, no, really, like it's in Canton. Let's go get it. And this is like the funniest story. We drag our husbands out to Canton and we're there and we're on this adorable little llama farm, which is where the name comes from. And our husbands were like just walking around it, checking it out. They're like, so are we taking this home? Like, what's happening? We're like, yeah, we're taking it home. And I mean, that was it. We started calling her.
That's kind of what happened.
The llama. The llama. Day one. So.
And then how much work had to be done to the llama?
A lot.
Okay. We did it all. I should say our husbands, with some help from family and friends. She was red at the beginning. We painted it. We did all the sanding, design.
The tile work.
I want everyone
who's listening to check out the pictures because it's so pretty.
Yes.
So as you guys were setting up this morning, I was noticing all the details. They're spectacular.
Thank you.
So how did you pick Pinteresting? How did you pick all the pieces?
Piece by piece, yeah. I think. Like it took 4 months or so from once we started sanding to the finished product. So week by week, we would kind of get together and pick little details for what the guys were doing that weekend.
We bought her in August and then did nothing for a full month
because she's married.
She's totally
like my trailer Lucy.
She's a total she.
I get it.
We really should give her a name, but we just always call her
the llama. The name. No, I'm into it. Like, don't change anything.
We see the llama.
What's the typical reaction when people see the llama?
I mean, typically they're just like, they're kind of shocked.
Yeah.
Because their mobile bars exist, right? They exist all over the United States. But what makes Detroit Mobile Bar different is it has a full experience. So there's a full keg. There's the option
custom
for
lighting too.
Four taps, custom lighting. I mean, it's the whole shebang. Like you don't need anything else. It keeps all your drinks cold. There's more space in it than people think. They're usually like, wow, this is a lot bigger than I thought.
Mm-hmm. It becomes an experience. Once you roll right up to a party, people want to bartend in it. They want to have fun with it. They're all outside of it, enjoying their cocktails. it's more of a fun experience for our clients and their guests.
That came across to me even looking at the pictures.
Good.
And I reached out to someone as I was researching you guys and said, I need to have a party just so I can have you guys over with the mobile bar because that's really all you need, right? Mm-hmm.
That's how people feel too. I mean, most of our clients, which we like to call our family, it's all DMB family, they know that the bar is just as important as, you know, their whole event. They want it to be just as unique, right? Mm-hmm. Their party is unique. So they want that nice touch, that something that your guests are going to leave still talking about. So
are you doing a lot of weddings? And yes. What types of parties? And what's been the most unusual party that you've done?
I would say we've done a bridal shower at a house, which was beautiful, gorgeous. It looked like it was a wedding. Mm. So, and our mobile bar right next to it was like the perfect addition to just make it.
It's been mostly weddings, bridal showers, birthday parties, and a lot of corporate parties. So it's perfect for a golf outing or something where you need something outside because it has its own generator. You don't have to be plugged up to anything. So we don't need to be near any power outlets or anything like that. It really is just this self-sufficient thing. I was going to say this earlier too, to like give the guys a little mad props here. We bought it in August, didn't touch it till after their wedding in September, and then it wasn't done until May. Like, the guys did everything. There was a point I would bring my two girls up there while we were doing the reno, and they'd be like, oh my gosh, what's happening today? And there was a point where the guys were like standing there with like a saw, and they're like, all right, so is this the side that you want the window to go on? Like, there's no turning back.
Oh, boy.
Right. There's no turning back. We're like, yeah, okay. And so we've joked the whole time that they're like Chip and we're Joanna. And they just like took care of all the work. And we're just like, this is where we want it.
So I have to wonder for the entrepreneurs or aspiring entrepreneurs who are listening, who are thinking about maybe working with friends or family or other couples, what has the experience been like for you guys working with your best friends? And what surprises have you found out about each other?
I would say no surprises.
Thankfully, knock on wood.
That's great.
I would say the opportunities that we have had together since we've done this mobile bar is probably the most memorable part of what we've been doing so far.
Yeah, and we've always hung out a lot. But I mean, literally, especially during the reno, we were together every single weekend. And we talk every single day. I think we have a bit of an advantage. Ron and I both have a real estate business together. I have another business. He's a lawyer. So like we've been juggling this way for a long time. So when we started this business, it didn't feel totally out of reach or different or new. It was just kind of like an extension of all the things.
Having this creative outlet to collaborate on.
Yeah. That's what we've said the most is this has been such a fun experience, like for both of us and for the guys. It's just fun. Mm-hmm. Like, well, there's times where we have parties and we're like, who should go? You guys or us? Because typically we'll split up or Kim and I will go and the guys will hang back. But most of the time we all want to go
because we all want to be a part of it. And we're enjoying the journey so much.
And watching the reactions, I would imagine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we really started the journey before the llama was even getting going. So since August, we've really been out there speaking about the journey. So everybody who has come to us is like, I've been following you since last year. And they're like really engrossed in the story of the llama and us. They know us really well. Like, it's just that kind of brand where we're all in it and it's fun.
So as someone who's interested in bringing the llama to their party, what do you suggest? What is the best process? How do they find you? Do you have a questionnaire? Do you like to understand the experience they're looking for?
Yes, we have our website. They can inquire directly, DetroitMobileBar.com. We're all over social media. So we're on Instagram, Facebook, Pinterest too. So if they're interested in inquiring, they can go right to pretty much any of those sites.
And typically they'll go to the website and there is a questionnaire on there, but as you can probably tell, everybody becomes family to us. So we jump on a call right away. We really want to understand what their event is about and how we can add to their event and to really make sure that it's personalized for their experience. So we have a pretty good conversation about how we can show up and how we can create this experience around this big event they've already been planning.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Well, this is the dream, really,
it's
right?
Fun.
For you guys, for the families and the, you know, the guests that you're working with. So thank you for coming over. Thank you for coming over to Lucy and bringing the llama. So let's go over to the llama and have a cocktail.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next guest is a former Division I volleyball player, a visionary, an advocate for change, and her special skill is her sense of humor. I asked Aki Chocolate from the College of Creative Studies to describe her, and he said, she's a superwoman. She's most recently the vice president of manufacturing at Shinola and currently president of the Industrial Sewing and Innovation Center in Detroit. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Danielle.
Thanks for coming over to Lucy.
Thank you. This is wonderful.
I'm so excited to talk to you.
Likewise.
I mean, we have a lot of things to cover.
Okay.
I want to know about playing volleyball.
Okay.
All kinds of things about your career in leather. I want to know, you know, you started as an illustrator. I want to know if you're still an illustrator.
Uh-huh.
So there's a lot. So as I was researching manufacturing and everything that you're doing, you know, with Aki, he's the chair of the fashion accessories department at CCS, and he's incredible. He's a force. He's a game changer here in Detroit. And as I've been watching him and how he's putting fashion on the radar here, people tend to know CCS for automotive, right? And being a feeder school to the big three. But I said, you need to keep your eye on Aki and what he's doing, right? So I've just been following it a bit, but as I'm researching you, I realize there's so much I don't know. There's so much I need to know. I think there's so much that our listeners are going to just be blown away by. There was a quote here by you that said, globally, the fashion and textile industry overproduces 15 billion more garments annually, and excess clothing ends up in landfills. That's partly driven by fast fashion brands like H&M and Zara, that depend on producing fashionable clothing in huge quantities cheaply to capitalize on trends quickly. They're overproducing 15 billion. I have goosebumps. You can't wrap your mind around it. What's happening?
It's really hard to put your head around it, and I think people are starting to, which is really wonderful. But the fashion industry essentially has been able to capitalize on inexpensive labor to project and do sort of speculative buying of product 6, 9, 12 months in advance. And when you do that, you're going to be wrong a lot of the time about what's going to sell, right? So,
right. So
what ends up happening is it gets here and it doesn't sell, or it never makes it here because they cancel orders because they've realized that the demand isn't what they thought it was. And so these products go into landfills. And so the fashion industry is understanding and realizing that that model no longer works. And it is a model that has long been broken, but now it's undeniable that it has to change. And so Aki and I and sort of the group of industry leaders in Detroit are vying to put Detroit on the map as a new center for apparel manufacturing to do it differently so that you can manufacture closer to the customer so you don't have to be speculative in your buying. So you can produce more sustainably. And Detroit has the opportunity to set it up as it could and should be because we don't have anything to deconstruct first, right? So that's what we're really excited about in Detroit.
Yeah. So by comparison, what's going on in New York, where we think of that as being the hub, but that would be broken as well.
Right. So we have a very good relationship with the Council of Fashion Designers America, and they're working very hard to restore, save, maintain the famed garment district, right? But it hasn't been invested in many, many years. And so it's archaic, it's old, it's hard to produce there because it's very, very expensive. And so the ecosystem that used to exist there has started to splinter apart. And so while they're working on saving the garment district there, they understand that in order to be competitive and in order to start bringing manufacturing back home, we need some other options rather than the hubs that we all think of, like New York and Los Angeles. So they understand their efforts are now spanning the nation now. It's not just, you know, New York-centric. They know we need more than that.
So here in Detroit, I feel like we have this great art community. I feel like it's been percolating for the last 10 to 15 years. Do you feel that's what's going on with fashion and manufacturing here in Detroit? Have we had the talent here for many years? We just haven't created the opportunities?
I think you're right. Detroit has an amazing amount of creative energy, and it long has. Just perhaps it hasn't had a place where it could be in the limelight and be shown upon or distributed. So I think what's happening now is that we're realizing that we want to not just attract creative talent here, but we want to keep creative talent here. We don't want them to have to leave to be successful. So we're beginning to understand that creatives like to be in a city where anything is possible. Mm. This is how creatives get motivated. And in Detroit, you can afford to do that. The barriers are smaller. And so it's attracting these sort of creative pioneers, I guess is what I would call them. And fashion is, how perfect is that, right? It's such a creative industry. And so I think that now we're starting to see, I get phone calls from people saying, you know, I hear that this is happening or this is happening in fashion. And I was thinking about moving, but you know what? I think I'm going to stick around to see what happens.
So in what areas? I mean, I know you're an advocate for empowering people to work with their hands. Mm-hmm. And I want to hear a little bit more about that. And, you know, even as I was researching all of these opportunities that you're creating, I found myself thinking, I love working with my hands. Had these opportunities been available for me 10, 15, 20 years ago, my life may have been on a different trajectory, right? Or there may have been different creative opportunities. So as people are reaching out to you or as you're creating more opportunities, in what realms are you kind of tapping into the talent or having the talent kind of come to you seeking these opportunities?
I think it's everything from design to manufacturing. And design can start on a conceptual level, right? So, you know, what is this thing that I'm imagining in my head that I want to create for the world? And then there's something in between design and manufacturing, which is technical design, which is where really the future of apparel manufacturing is happening. It's how do we bridge those things quickly and well using innovation and technology? And then there's actually manufacturing. And having set up the leather division at Shinola and watching people who had never made leather goods in their life be trained from the very beginning to make leather goods, and now we have full of masters at Shinola now that know how to make leather goods, it's really fulfilling. And it can be a very, very good career if you understand the path that it can take, right? So I think the way I think of it is we as a culture talk a lot about the skills gap. And I argue that it's actually not that, it's a value gap. We don't value what people do with their hands enough. We don't value making things enough. And if we did, I don't believe we'd have a skills gap because everybody would want to go into those fields, right?
Right. I agree completely. So what impact do you think technology is having on all of this? And where do you see the trends going? So, you know, I have four little boys and I was asking them yesterday, where do you think we'll be in 5 years? Right. And now they're 7, 8, and 10, right? So it's kind of like a lofty question for them, right? And so one of my 10-year-olds had been begging me for a phone for a long time. And I said, you don't need a phone, right? They just don't need that much access. They don't need the distractions.
Good for you, Mom.
Well, yeah, I try. And I said, listen, you can have a cell phone when you make travel hockey, right? So they've all been playing hockey. I say they turn two,
makes sense.
And
yeah,
we lace them up. We push them on the ice. People ask me all the time if they like playing hockey. And I say, I don't know. They don't really have an option, right? So I said, listen, when you make travel hockey, you can have a cell phone. All four make travel hockey, right? And they're like, yes, we get cell phones. And I'm going, oh my goodness. Again, they don't need that much access. They don't need the apps. They don't need, you know, people to be able to find them. Mm-hmm. So I bought them all flip phones. And I know.
That
right?
could make them retro cool.
So for everyone listening, if you could see our faces right now, we're elated because they are retro cool, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they were so excited about their flip phones. I started to feel a little guilty. And fortunately, when they would tell any grown up, I got a flip phone, everyone's reaction was the same as yours. Oh my gosh, right? And most people said, oh, I loved my flip phone. I missed my flip phone.
Yeah.
So anyway, and now what happened? They played with them for about 3 months and then they completely forgot about them and they're not interested in anymore. So it's kind of been interesting for me to observe them, to observe what I see. I'm, you know, a trustee at their school, what I see going on with technology throughout the schools, what I see going on in the community. My husband, of course, is in technology and software development. So back to my conversation with them yesterday, I was asking, as I was researching you, in fact, you know, what do you guys think is going to happen in 5 years with iPads and social media? Mm-hmm. Do you think people will be spending more or less time on social media, on their devices? And they all said more. And I thought, okay, that's fair for them to see it that way. And I thought that's a little disheartening.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was telling them, I hope it's the opposite. I hope we see the trends kind of getting us away from so much screen time and the importance of eye contact and social interaction and skill trades. So my point is, as I'm researching you and I'm thinking about the lost art. It's an art, right? The lost art of working with your hands. Yep. And I'm thinking about the people that you were saying, the talent really that you trained at Shinola, mm-hmm. right? Who had maybe never worked with leather before. Right. And then they went through your training process, which is, of course, is very involved because you can't waste leather, right? Right. And by the end, they're masters of this trade.
Right.
Right. And I know I was coming across some interviews you had done and some TED Talks where you know, as technology is evolving, it can't take the place of skilled workers.
Yeah. And I really don't subscribe to the idea that automation robotics are going to just replace human beings. I think that it changes what human beings can be reserved to do. I'd like to think that we will now reserve our most special human talents and let the stuff that's more mundane and doesn't really call upon our special human talents, and we allocate that to technology. And I think, you know, I was having a conversation with my dad the other day, and my grandmother was born in 1902, and we were talking about Apollo 11, right? Everybody's talking about the anniversary. And he said, think about it. Your grandmother, when she was born, there was no planes. And before she died, she saw planes and then a man on the moon. Well, innovation and technology will always continue to happen as long as we have the creative brain of human beings, right? So whether we call it technology or innovation or whatever it is, it'll always happen. I think it's just incumbent on us to decide how much we want to have it run our lives versus be a tool for our lives. And I think that's where the rub is, right? So in apparel manufacturing, I think it can actually unleash faster, more democratic realization of designs because of those tools versus just replacing everybody. I don't think that's going to happen, at least not for a good spell.
So you started as an illustrator.
Right.
Are you still illustrating? And what tools do you use?
Yeah, you know, I don't illustrate anymore. And I've often thought it's probably time I start doing that because I miss it. But, you know, whether it's a fashion illustration or it's classic fashion design, those traditional skills that you learn help to inform how you need technology to work for you. So when I was first fashion illustrating, you know, there weren't all these digital tools that I could have used to make that whole process faster or even be produced or reproduced, printed easier, better. But I wouldn't have known what I needed technology to do for me had I not understood the very fundamental of creation, right? So I think, you know, I believe with industrial sewing, you teach those traditional skills, and those same people you're teaching those industrial skills, you teach the same skills that are going to be required for emerging technologies. So they understand it all now, right? So it all makes more sense. It makes them more connected to how they use technology and what they need it for.
Do you feel like people are learning differently? The way they think and process information has changed?
I do. I don't think we do enough three-dimensional learning, right? I mean, I don't know about you. Wait, when you were growing up, when you made that painting or whatever that your parents stuck on the fridge, right?
Right.
There's a source of pride and, you know, you made that, mm-hmm. right? Nobody else did. That's a human, it's a very human trait that we're very proud of what we make.
Right.
And I think making three-dimensional things taps into that. And I think that's why you see the development of all these maker spaces and people going yeah. back to handmade this, handmade that, whether it's food or clothes or whatever, because it's a human trait to mm-hmm. get satisfaction from that, I think.
Mm-hmm. So I love to knit, right? So as we're sitting here in Lucy, yeah. I don't think there's anything in here that I've made, but we have, you know, and anyone who's listening can see us online. We have quilts and blankets and a lot of pieces that were crafted. And in fact, I finished knitting a clutch over the weekend. And uh-huh. there's, first of all, it's very cathartic. Do you knit?
I crochet.
Oh, you do?
I don't anymore, but that's what my thing was, I used to crochet.
Yeah, yeah. What would you make?
I made shawls and caps, that kind of thing. Yeah.
I mean, there's just something very, like I said, cathartic about it, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And they're great gifts. And there's yep. just some sort of an emotional attachment to something that you've made with your hands.
Yeah, you don't get rid of it, right?
You don't.
It's not disposable.
No.
And that's the other thing is when you buy something that is just available whenever.
Right.
It doesn't mean anything.
Right.
You know.
So is there something that you currently make with your hands? Do you have a hobby or an outlet or... Do you feel drawn to this as you're teaching and creating these opportunities?
I live thoroughly and entirely vicariously through the people that I work with that make the stuff.
I really do.
I suppose I feel like my talents are needed to do something other than that, and they're mm-hmm. better than I am at it, but trust me, I love being around. And that's why my desk is in the factory, because I love being right there.
Yeah.
You know, I love being a part of that process.
So are you in the middle of the action? You're not in, are you in an office?
No, my desk is right on the factory floor.
And how many people do you have around you working?
40 in the leather factory.
Really?
And as we build out ISIC, which is the Industrial Sewing and Innovation Center, I plan to do the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I won't have an office in the penthouse. I'll be
so
down there
with all of the sewing machines around you.
Oh yeah.
So it'll be a little loud.
Yeah, which is
completely fine. Fantastic.
Yeah.
I took a tour a few weeks ago of Veronica Scott's empowerment plan and walked through the space where all the women were sewing, and it's so energizing and seeing all the raw materials.
Isn't it great?
It's so great. Mm-hmm. It's so great. So do you find as people are coming to you, are they coming and wanting to learn these skills? Are they coming out of college? Are they looking for other opportunities?
Right now, ISIC is focused on using this industry and the opportunities within it to give underserved Detroiters an opportunity that they may not otherwise have. So it's usually under or unemployed, although we are starting to talk with Detroit Public Schools about beginning much earlier, so that we're talking about in high school.
Yeah.
To expose kids to this trade much earlier on. Mm-hmm. But right now it's adults, young adults.
And what partners are coming out of the woodwork? Yeah. I know there are a few biggies in the industry and a few that are local.
So
what's going on?
So Carhartt is our main partner who's really made this all happen. And they're dedicating a 12,000 square foot space above their store on Cass to the ISIC factory. Mm-hmm. They've just been tremendous, tremendous partners. They've helped us in so many ways, and they're going to be helping us with equipment. And so they have just been, I mean, I just can't say enough good things about working with the Carhartt folks. And then we have the CFDA, the Council of Fashion Designers of America, out of New York, working very closely with them. And then we just received our first national grant from Autodesk Foundation out of San Francisco, which is really exciting. That's some of the technical piece. And then we do have our first major Detroit foundation that I can't announce yet.
Okay.
But they're our lead grantor.
That's great.
So it's really super exciting.
And how long have you been in Detroit?
6 years now. Came on my 6-year anniversary.
So were there any big surprises? What did you think when you moved here?
Yes.
And now you grew up in California.
I did. Okay. I grew up in California, although I was born in Oakland, California, which... it's sort of like the Detroit of California in a sense. You know, Oakland's had some similar challenges. But when we moved here, my husband and I said, okay, if we're going to do this, we're going to live and work in Detroit. We're going to really immerse ourselves. But I came first. And I was here for about 6 months. And I thought, you know, I'd heard all the other stories that you hear about Detroit. And I thought, you know, I'm tall. I'm 5'11". I'm a strong woman. No one's going to mess with me. I'll be so fine. You know, I'll be good. I'm talking myself into, you know, I'm going to have to like look out for myself. And the biggest surprise was that it's the people. Detroiters are amazing people. I love Detroiters. They could not have been, and they continue to be, welcoming, hospitable, grounded, available, no pretense. And for sure, that was the biggest surprise in coming to Detroit. Absolutely the people, no question.
Yeah, you know, I think Detroiters were tough and were scrappy. And I often say, relative to the art community, we don't suffer fools lightly. Right. If you're not the real deal.
You got good sniffers.
Good sniffers. Yeah. Like, this is not a place for phonies or frauds or fools.
Right.
But we're the Midwest. Right. Mm-hmm. And I feel like generally we are good people and we have good values.
It's like Detroit is Midwest, but with some brawn, you know, with some biceps, you know, and with some, you know, heavy duty work pants, you know. It's so hard to explain to people, but I'll tell you, of all the places I've lived, we have more people want to come visit us in Detroit than anywhere I've ever lived.
Really?
And hands down, no one ever leaves without going, oh my gosh, I've just fallen in love with Detroit. Hands down, every single time.
Every time I travel, someone says Detroit.
Right.
You're making a comeback, right?
Yeah, right.
I think we did.
Yeah, that's
I think it happened.
Past tense, yeah.
Come visit.
Yeah.
So you grew up in California.
Yeah.
So you played Division A or Division
One
volleyball.
I did.
So what was that like? So did you grow up as an athlete?
Well, I was a latecomer that, you know, you probably couldn't be anymore with the way clubs are set up for kids. Right. I didn't even start playing until I was a freshman in high school.
Okay.
And I just took to it really quickly.
So were you recruited because you're tall?
Pretty much. Okay. I was in, you know, PE class, uh-huh. and, you know, the poor, you know, 20-something-year-old coach was like, hey, there's a tall one, right. you know? So I tried basketball first and played that, but then the volleyball coach said, you know, if you're good at that, you might, and then volleyball, I mean, I just fell in love with it. So volleyball, team sports in general, it's formed a lot of who I am.
Yeah.
You know, there's just no question. I love working with people. I love working with teams. I like putting together diverse people with a common thing. And, you know, the sense of satisfaction you get when you achieve something together is amazing. And I was also one of the early, I mean, this is, you know, this is going to age me. I was one of the first that was part of Title IX. So I was one of the few, you know, where I went to school that got a full ride scholarship.
Wow.
You know, fully paid. And at the time, that was a fairly new thing, you know. So for me, I mean, I was hugely blessed by that. So I can't say enough good about it.
Do you still play?
I played up until about 6 years ago when I thought
until
I did
came to Detroit.
Oh, no, no, you know what happened? You know what happened? This was a really sad day. I thought I had done something to my knee, so I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, well, what do you do for exercise? And I said, well, I do this and that, and I play volleyball. And he said, yeah. Wait a second, what kind of volleyball? And I said, well, you know, we still play with, you know, some ex-collegiate athletes. And he said, you know, has anybody ever told you it's not a lifelong sport? And I was like, oh no. You know, and
you need a new doctor.
I know. I just no.
So he said, I don't think that's the right doctor for you.
He said, you know, just try to, don't go so hard on the court. Well, I tried that. Well, it's impossible. You can't turn off the connection between your mind and your body. So I stopped playing, and yeah, it was a sad day, I have to admit.
No.
Yeah, it was a sad day.
I want you to play again.
Who knows?
Who knows?
Maybe
right?
I do need to find the right doctor saying,
maybe.
Hey, you know,
I box a lot, and I have some rotator things, and I dislocated my ribs, and I go to someone for Rolfing. Have you tried Rolfing?
Oh, Rolfing's good. I've only done it
fabulous,
once.
Fabulous, right? So there's a guy.
See, you know what? I just need to find a new doctor,
I think you need
a new practitioner.
Guy. And this guy, this Rolfing guy, when I go to him and I try and see him every other week and I cancel probably every other time. And he's like kind of, you know, Rolfing, for people who are listening who don't know, it's like a little bit of a cross between a chiropractor and physical therapist and a deep tissue massage.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not relaxing. They kind of take you apart, put you
and
back
together.
And
the range you get from it, right?
But then after, you just like float out of there, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Every time I go, he said, you know what? Can you hit a little softer? Can you hit a little less hard?
I didn't know this was going to be a motivating podcast. This is awesome. I'm going to like...
We take all sorts of twists and turns around here. We, like I said, rarely stick to the questions. We talk about family and, you know, health and all sorts of things. But yeah, the Rolfing. But I get it. So he said, I need you to not hit so hard. And I said, he says it to me all the time.
Yeah.
I said, but you know, I'm going to. Because I only work at one mode, right? I mean,
yeah.
You either go
What's
hard or
point,
go home.
Right?
What's the point? So maybe somebody listening has some ideas for you.
Yeah,
we need to find you a new doctor.
Yes.
I think it can be lifelong. Yeah. Did you ever play beach volleyball?
I did.
You did?
Yeah.
It's so hard. How?
It's incredibly hard. If I tried it now, it would be a sad sight. But it's an intensely physical game.
Intensely.
And you have to be good at all aspects of the game for beach volleyball. On a 6-person team indoor, you can kind of be good at certain parts of it.
Yeah.
And outdoor, you have to be good at everything.
And just moving in the sand.
Oh, yeah. It's a quick way to get in shape,
I'll
tell you.
We have friends who are friends with Gabrielle Reese.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right? And so she is just superhuman, right?
She is.
And we were visiting friends in California, and she said, hey, do you want to go walk up and down some sand dunes? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I can hang. No, I can't hang with Gabrielle Reese.
Yeah, she's like, no big deal for me. Right, right.
She's extraordinary.
Yeah.
So I admire you. So if you're not playing volleyball, what do you like to do now?
Well, two things. First of all, I'm a huge animal lover, and so
They
are my children. So I definitely, you know, if I could have a farm with any dog that needed a home, I would do that.
I love Lucy
so
much.
Exactly.
You get this whole experience at
completely.
The garden and the campfire.
I would be Doris Day. I would.
Oh.
But the other is, you know, when we moved to Detroit, Larry and I agreed that we would just say yes to every single invitation we had to anything, just to get to know Detroiters and get to know Detroit. And through that, I have
been
so blessed. Oh, and it was the most amazing experience. So what it led to was getting to know so many different people that do different things. And I guess a lot of my free time, I spend mentoring small businesses, you know, people that are, you know, kind of ready to get to the next level, like Charisma Eve, the jewelry designer, mm-hmm. or Ross and Karamoka of Detroit is the New Black. Unofficially, just mm-hmm. I'd like to be there for them. And, you know, they'll drop a line or call or whatever when they might have a question about something. And so I spend a lot of time doing that. I really love to hopefully help folks that are starting new businesses or trying to grow them not have to learn the hardest way possible. Mm-hmm. And if there's even one little thing that I can do to help,
yeah,
it's really fulfilling. So I spent a lot of time doing that.
So what was your experience like coming up and your experience out of college? Did you feel like it was a hard road? Did you have a mentor?
I had a mentor that changed my life in a way my parents almost disowned me over, but it turned out great.
Really?
I had this vision. I was going to be like Jacqueline Cousteau. I wanted to be this oceanographer. I was going to get my bachelor's in biography and then go on to Scripps Institute to be an oceanographer. And along the way, I had a couple mean lab professors that, you know, kind of wagged their finger at me and said, you know, you're going to be in the lab for years before you ever see the ocean. I was like, oh, that's not what I want, you know. And along the way, I took an elective and it was an illustrator.
You wanted to be using your hands, right? You wanted to be out touching and working.
Exactly. I don't want to be in lab, right?
I'm getting the pieces of this puzzle, right?
Okay. You're connecting the dots for sure. So along the way, I took a class and that professor took a real interest in what I was doing. And she basically created a special BFA for me. And I started illustrating and realized that I learned about life through art. That's how I learn life. And so it changed my whole entire life. And I told my parents that, you know, I was going to do that. And they just said, you know, well, that's great, but how are you going to learn a living? I guess it's about time you start paying for your own school then. I said, right. Okay. And that was fair. Mm-hmm. That was okay.
And now, do you have siblings?
I have two half-sisters. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think what it did, though, it really launched me in a totally different path, and it was not a linear path, but from there, I went into the fashion industry and started getting work printed, and from then, I sort of...
So up until that point, it wasn't a field or an area that you'd been interested in. No, you'd been college athlete and volleyball and animals, and then here comes fashion, and it just kind of knocks you over, and...
But looking back, though, I used to, you know, make things and sew things and make doll clothes and, like, all that stuff. You know, I loved all that stuff. So it kind of makes sense looking back at it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened in the fashion industry, I learned that I'm definitely right and left brain. So I don't like to be all creative and all business. I like the place where they merge. And so I've held a lot of different positions in the fashion industry. And so I can sort of get a picture of how all those gears link to make something work. And I really enjoy that space.
So the illustrating, is that something that you had always done, even working in different areas or having an interest in different areas with
pretty much.
Animals?
I've always, Yeah. I love illustrating for sure. Okay. Yeah. And I really don't do any of it anymore. And I need to start doing that again because it's a great outlet for me for sure. Yeah.
And so then out of college, what comes next?
So out of college, went to Los Angeles, and ignorance is truly, truly bliss. Mm-hmm. I went thinking, hey, you know, I have printed work. I'm going to take my portfolio and walk around the garment district and just show my stuff. Someone will hire me.
You're here.
And and little did I know that there were a lot of people out there doing that. I thought I was the only one, but I got work. I got work right away and started to work for a buying agency who needed people to illustrate some of the things that they wanted to represent to buyers. And through that, I met designers and started to work in the leather goods industry and sat side by side designers and realized that some designers don't know how to draw. So that came in handy. And so learned how to design, and that sort of kicked off my career in fashion. And that was it.
And then you continued working with leather. And so where did that take you? And then it comes a big move.
Yeah. So, you know, I designed and then I got into more product development, which is less design, more about, you know, the fabrication and purchasing. And then I went into brand management and then I went into marketing and then I started to learn about the finances of it and the operations of it. Then I started to learn about manufacturing, and that all led to a partner of mine at the time, business partner of I, we bought a 100-year-old leather goods company in Minneapolis or St. Paul, Minnesota. Mm. And that's where all the things that I had learned got to come together in one place. So I was CEO of that company and we sort of turned this 100-year-old brand around and gave it a, you know, a little freshening up and turned the company around at a time that American manufacturing was making its way back. So that's where all the pieces came together. And that's how I met Tom Cartsotis of Shinola.
Mm.
So that's what got me
and
here.
And what were, at that company, what were you manufacturing?
Leather goods, everything from women's handbags, men's handbags, briefcases, luggage. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So leather accessories.
And then you come over to Shinola, which is really exciting here in Detroit, especially the time, you know, 6 years ago. It's still very exciting, right?
Yeah.
So what was that process like coming in and working with Tom, who's fabulous and energetic and has
big
ideas?
He's the Pied Piper. He knows how to like get people excited about stuff he's interested in. And I was certainly one of them. You know, I said, it took me a couple years to really go, okay, do I really want to do this? And no looking back once I was here. So we built out a leather studio, leather factory. It was really an opportunity to do what I had already been doing, but on a larger scale and in a city that I felt we could have some lasting impact. Mm-hmm. Then I began to work with College for Creative Studies, mm-hmm. CCS. And so that relationship started to grow and we started to work with them on programming and building their curriculum for their fashion accessory design program. So all these dots started to connect.
And so what did you think about that? What did you think of CCS? Like I said, you know, for me, I grew up here in Detroit. I'm on the board of CCS. And like I said, I've always seen CCS as being a feeder or really being focused on the automotive industry, mm-hmm. which is fantastic, mm-hmm. right? I mean, there's a lot of work here. So when Aki moved here and fashion, to me, was suddenly on the radar, it was so exciting. This, like I said, it's a game changer. I think he's a game changer. For you coming in 6 years ago, what have you seen?
I think Aki has been a game changer. And I think having Shinola and that program in the same building has been a really, really cool thing to see happen. And what I personally think has been amazing about this space is that CCS was interested in fashion. They knew they were. But in looking at all the other schools, they didn't want to just offer a curriculum that everybody else was offering. And there wasn't really a program for fashion accessories design, even though it's a huge market, that taught design to manufacture. So meaning that, you know, Aki allows and demands, you know, real creativity and real, you know, real imagination in creating designs. But he also demands that you know how to make it. And fashion schools, that's often where they fall short.
Mm.
So these kids, they have to make this stuff, which changes your understanding of design. You now appreciate that, you know, if I design it this way, that's going to be impossible to make,
mm-hmm.
right? So that is where CCS, what they do so well, came into play, because CCS's strength is that they partner with industry to understand what industry needs.
Mm-hmm.
So this program develop skill that industry needs, because right now industry, you know, you get designers and you have to really teach them how to make stuff because they don't know how to make stuff.
Right.
So they have to go to a second kind of school. It's just on the job, right?
Right.
But they really know how to prepare students for what industry needs. And I think that's what Aki is doing there. He's really providing a curriculum there that is, it's unlike anyone in the country.
Mm, I agree. And so I'm thinking of parents who are listening or someone who's interested in fashion. Maybe they're looking at colleges. What would your advice be? Where should they get their training? What should they focus on?
I would say that, you know, if you have a child that says they want to design, I would certainly encourage that. But I would really, really ask their kids to find a way to also become very proficient in technical design. Because technical design is a big gap and it's needed. It's very high paying. It's where innovation comes into play. A lot. It's where innovation is going to continue to come into play. And oftentimes design and manufacturing and design and technical design is looked upon as, oh, that's infringing on the creative mind. You know, don't confuse them with technical stuff. Well, that's just baloney. Mm. That's just baloney. So I would encourage students and parents to find curriculums that offer the creative element, but also really, really require of the students that they become really good technical designers. Because that's going to set them up for success,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
And so moving forward with the Industrial Sewing and Innovation Center in Detroit, and you're in the Carhartt building,
yes.
right? Are you in the Carhartt building now?
They're in the process of building it out. So
okay.
we hope to cut the ribbon in January.
Mm-hmm.
We still have some fundraising to do. So we've raised about $1.2 million in granted dollars, and then we've raised over $2 million in-kind contributions.
That's fantastic.
So in total, over $3 million, and we have about $2 million more to raise. And I think we're going to be just fine. But the Institute is actually going to start operationally in a scaled back way starting in September.
Okay.
That's the nonprofit side of Isaac.
Okay.
So that's the side that really focuses on education and training and even works with cities like New York to implement workforce development programs. And then we have a for-profit factory subsidiary that includes profit for the workers in the factory.
Mm.
And that's the part that self-sustains ongoing apprenticeship. So that's the interface between those two things. So the factory will be there. The institute work will start in September. We've already developed a curriculum that's certified by the Department of Labor. And by the way, the empowerment plan is the first one to implement it.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So we have our director of workforce development working actually this week. They are at the empowerment plan helping to implement that program there. So now the folks that they serve, when they finish their apprenticeship, they'll have an apprenticeship certified card that says that they're masters.
That's great.
I know. It's really exciting. Yeah.
So what is the application process like? So anyone who's listening or knows someone who might be interested, how do they get into these different areas?
Yeah. So I think the best thing is just to go on isaac.org and just email us. Let us know what your area of interest is. There is a prerequisite class that you have to take to get into apprenticeship, and Henry Ford is teaching that right now. Next year, Isaac Institute will also teach it. So there'll be several places that you can get that class taken care of. It's 200 hours. But any interest you have in fashion apparel, whether it's manufacturing design, please just email us. Go on the website, let us know. And if we're not the direct link for you, we will find the direct link for you.
And now, are you still, how many pets do you have?
Yeah.
I don't want to forget that.
It's not out of time. It's not too bad. Two cats and one dog. We did have two dogs, but when our old gal passed away last year, we discovered that our remaining boy liked to be the solo chief.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, he wasn't one of those dogs that missed his compadre. He was like, this is good. I like being the big cheese. So we call him a Dabrador because he's part Dane and part Lab. So he's a big Lab. So yeah. That's our Ringo. Ringo's his name.
Oh, I love it.
So three pets.
Oh. So I have to just circle back. You know, at the beginning, I was reading your quote about the fashion industry overproducing $15 billion. I mean, I just have to get back to that number because, you know, who doesn't love to shop at H&M and Zara, and it's easy and quick? I mean, it's just mind-boggling to think that that's the current state of the fashion industry.
Yeah, you have to know when you do that, the only way that works is by exploiting impoverished labor. You have to know that the reason that works is impoverished labor. Okay. And it works because we don't care what it does to the planet when we're shipping things all around the planet. So understand that if you buy something that's more expensive, that's made well, closer to home, that you're doing much better for the planet, for people, and you're less likely to throw it out. So the whole fashion industry is upside down right now because they know that it has to shift. So they're really looking to more on-demand sort of models. So how can I make what Danielle Carmanos wants today and get it to her in a couple days? So that's where it's headed, because then you have no waste.
Right.
Right? So that's where technology is coming in. So how do we do this so we can get you what you want, when you want, within reason, and made close to home? So that's where the whole industry is going.
So do you feel like, you know, as we're creating these opportunities in Detroit, is the industry starting to look to Detroit? Are we there yet?
Yes.
Okay.
I am happy to say that there are some major global brands that are doing very serious due diligence about coming to Detroit.
That's exciting.
Yes.
It's exciting.
Very exciting.
All right,
Jen,
thank you for being our guest.
Thank you
for coming over to Lucy to Play.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, let's talk soon.
Yeah,
you got to keep following everything that you're doing, and this has really been exciting.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
This has been the Karma Has Spoken podcast. If you like today's content, feel free to share our show by email, social media, or any other means. If you've got a question, comment, or other feedback, visit our website at karmahasspoken.com. Keep up with us by subscribing to Karma Has Spoken in your favorite podcast app, or follow Karma Has Spoken on social media. Karma Has Spoken is a production of Jag and Detroit Podcasts.